Welcome, I'm Bhante Sujato, and we're here to have some Dhamma. Sorry, there's just a sneeze, I think I'm good. All right, so today marks the first talk we've been giving after the end of the rains retreat. Actually, could you get some tissues? See if there's some tissues there. That's fine. It's just better than nothing. That's fine. Thanks. Just in case. Bit of hay fever. So it's the first talk for the after the end of the rains, the Vasa, over the next period we'll be continuing these teachings, but I will be back at Crow's Nest next Wednesday. Is that right?
Yes.
I'll be back at Crow's Nest Community Center next Wednesday, and so we'll be continuing those talks, especially for people in the eastern part of Sydney. And I'll mainly be doing it also with Venerable Karunika. And I think she's going to come down once a month, is that right? So I will be coming down around roughly once a month, and we'll be supporting each other for that. After the end of the rains retreat is the Buddhist Katina season. Okay, so just a brief explanation for Katina. The Katina is a robe that was originally actually meant a frame upon which a robe was made, but today it's used as a ceremony to mark the end of the rains retreat or the rainy season. And the special purpose of the Katina is to celebrate the connection between the monastic community and the lay community who support them. And so we are, most of the places around the place are doing Katina ceremonies. Of course, since I live by myself, I can't do a kind of official Katina, which requires a minimum of five bhikkhus or bhikkhunis. But we are doing a ceremony, and that is on the... this coming Sunday on November the 5th, and that's at the Wentworth Park something. Anyway, it's on our website, so you can see that if you're in Sydney. Just go to Wentworth Park and wander around, and then you should find your way. Santi's just posted they're doing theirs at the 19th of November, and everybody else will be doing theirs at other times. So it's a good chance to go along, even a good chance to sort of see if there's some monasteries in the area that you don't necessarily know about. Drop by, say good day, see. I think Lankarama's having theirs, I think, tomorrow.
Yes.
And I think they're doing like all-night paritta chanting or something tonight. So there are a few people who are out there doing the paritta chanting. So if that is all night chanting, if you're in Sydney, you can go straight from here and go and do the all night chanting. It's good. It's good. It's definitely worth doing. And so it's a nice time to participate because it's really all about community at this time. All right, let us do some chanting. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi,
Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti piso bhagavārahaṃ sammāsambuddho vijjācharana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhammasārati Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati Svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhittiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko Pachatam veditabbo vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho Ujjupatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho Nyayapatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho Samichi patipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Yadidam chattari purisa yugani Artha purisa pungala Esa bhagavato sahavaka sangho Ahuneyo pahuneyo Dakirneyo Anjali Karaniyo Anutaram Punyaketa Lokasati.
All right, very, very good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Just one or two folks coming in. Do we know what they're celebrating?
Sorry?
Sounds like they're celebrating something.
Have you been to Diwali?
Sorry?
Yeah, I think it's Diwali.
Oh, it's Diwali, is it?
I think so. I didn't.
Ah. So, don't wear your good clothes if you're going down there.
Polly.
All right. So for today's meditation, we're going to do some mindfulness of breathing. The Buddha said that mindfulness of breathing is like the wind which comes and blows away the leaves. And so mindfulness of breathing, it's okay, Nilushi. Otherwise, if we don't have the window open, then it'll get really stuffy very quickly because it's quite a... Sorry?
Slightly ajar,
Whatever, yeah, but it does get stuffy, yeah. What was I saying? Oh, yeah, so mindfulness of breathing is like the wind that blows away the leaves, not like one of those horrible leaf blowers that we use these days. I hate those things with a passion. But anyway, but like the, and there's, that's a nice simile because it's talking about the way that the mindfulness of breathing dispels the five hindrances. And it's one of the things that I always try to emphasize when speaking about mindfulness of breathing meditation is that it's not about what you're doing in order to make your mind peaceful or in order to get rid of your hindrances, but the breath is the one that is blowing and making those hindrances go away. So when we think about mindfulness of breathing meditation, we think about relinquishing control, about surrender, and about letting go. The peace, the calm, the pleasure, the satisfaction, the insight, the clarity that comes from mindfulness of breathing meditation comes because we have let go. Primarily, we've let go of the five hindrances, which are, sorry, remind me what the five hindrances are again?
Sensual desire.
Sensual desire.
Aversion.
Aversion. Self and torpor. Restless and remorse. What's the last one? Okay, very good. So five hindrances. And so the good news is that mindfulness of breathing will take care of those hindrances for you. You don't have to go rushing about thinking, how can I solve this hindrance? How can I solve that hindrance? I mean, in some cases, sure. Right? In some cases, maybe you're hit with a lot of anger and you've got to sort of figure out how to manage that. But most of the time, if your mind is okay and your mind is reasonably balanced and okay, then we just breathe. We be mindful of our breathing, and the mindful, and that mindfulness of breathing takes care of all of those hindrances for us. And so we can let go. We don't have to get involved at all. It's not about you. It's not about, you know, are you a good meditator? Are you doing the right method? Do you have the right teacher? Is this the right posture? Are you in the right place? Is this the right time? Do you have the right, do you have the right karma to be doing this? And are you paying attention at the right point at your nose tip or somewhere else? Are you counting in the right way? Are you doing this? It's not about any of those things. It's about letting go. So all of those other things, don't worry about them too much. Right? Obviously, you want to get a nice posture, you want to have a good place, you want to have all of those things. But they're not the thing that really matters. What matters is letting go. Yeah? So try to not try. Strive to not strive. Make an effort to not make an effort. That's why meditation is such fun. Now, when we start to become aware of the breathing, one of the things that becomes most obvious is that the breathing starts to become rough or tense, like we can feel like our stomach even tensing up, maybe our head tensing up or our face tensing up, and we can feel this tightness coming around the breath. And the breathing that we've been doing our whole life without any problem suddenly becomes a problem. Yeah? This is upadana, this is grasping and attachment. That's what you're bringing into the breath. So this is a very common thing that happens in the course of meditation. So when that happens, we sort of sit back just a little bit from the breath. Just relax, okay. Just letting the breath coming in and going out. Right? And so we aim for that exquisite sense of poise, neither pushing forward nor pulling back. Just present. So if you find that you're getting too tight around the breath, then pull back just a little bit. Yeah? If you find that your mind is, you know, you're falling asleep, getting dull and confused, then maybe apply onto the breath a little bit more. Yeah? But ultimately we want, but just a little bit. Right? So we don't, we just use this very kind of gentle touch to move forward or move back and to find that sense of balance. Your mind will find that balance by itself because your mind wants to be happy. You see, when we sit down to meditate, your intention, right, your overall volition to meditate is to be able to let go and to find happiness. That's what you want. That's why you're here. So trust that. And don't get caught up in all of the kind of the surface stuff. You see, this is what you find that happens to people in meditation all the time. They come to meditate, and then they're like, oh, my meditation was no good because I was thinking about this or thinking about that. And they think, oh, their mind was messed up. No. Your mind was good because you meditated. So sure, yeah, all those other things maybe were imperfections and so on that we can work on, but it doesn't mean that your mind is messed up. The fact that you've had the intention to come and meditate says that your mind is in a good place and you're actually setting it in the right direction. So don't worry about too much about all of those other things. And many years ago I made a sort of casual remark that some of the different Dhamma teachers often have catchphrases that they use. Like Ajahn Chah would say, my nares is not certain. And Lumpur Liam would say, Lao Te, it depends. And somebody said, oh, your one is, I wouldn't worry about it too much. So that's my kind of catchphrase, you know. So, fair enough. So, as we learn to let go, we let the breath become present in its subtle form. It manifests to us as both a physical impression as well as a mental concept or idea of the breath. And the deeper that we go into meditation, the more that we'll find that that physical impression will become very, very, very soft. You know, human senses are incredibly sensitive. Like we can touch something and just feel this tiniest bit of roughness or something in that surface. You know, our senses are incredible. Same with hearing. You can be in a very, very quiet place and you can hear just a very, very small sound. And so when you're doing mindfulness of breathing, you can feel even that very, very soft touch of the breath, and your mind can become so clear that you can just tell something which is very subtle. But even so, it can still become too subtle so that you can't even see it anymore. You can't even be aware of it. That's how subtle your breath can become. It's becoming that subtle because your body is becoming calm and the energies in your body don't require that much air, that much oxygen to work. So you're actually calming down your body and your mind. And so as that physical touch of the breath recedes in awareness, what becomes apparent is the mental aspect of that same breath, which you can think of as a concept, if you like, but it doesn't appear to the mind as a concept. It's not a concept in the sense of an abstract idea about something. It's a concept in the sense of being a mental counterpart that's perceived in the mind. And typically we see that as a light, as a radiance, as a feeling of pleasure, happiness, and we call that the nimitta. And so this starts to manifest, and you start to feel like a brightness in your mind and a pleasure and a happiness in your mind. And this is a sign. The word nimitta literally means sign. It's a sign that that the hindrances are diminishing and that the mindfulness and the samadhi is growing. That's what we mean when we say something's a nimitta. We say it's a sign that your mind is going in that right direction. So let's do some mindfulness of breathing meditation. And we'll see what kind of signs that our minds have for us today. Okay. And sitting quietly, softly and gently, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And when your mind wanders off about thinking about this and that, be clearly aware of it and let it go and come back to your breath and let your breath calm you down. Let your breath bring its sweetness to you. Let your breath bring its care to you. Let the breath bring its brightness to you. And now coming near to the end of the meditation. I want you to come back into your senses. Listen to the sounds around. Feel the touch of the cloth on your skin. And just check how your mind is now, especially as compared to how it was before. Does your mind feel more clear, more rested, more whole? What was the perception of the breath like during the meditation? Did you see the breath clearly? How did it change? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. Let's have a short break and we'll come back for some Dhamma talk. Just briefly to answer the question, I've got a question from Aparna in Houston. How's it going, Aparna? Asked, what's the difference between the method I'm teaching and Ajahn Brahm's method? Well, not much. I don't know. I mean, I guess we have a different personality, a different approach sometimes. But Ajahn Brahm teaches present moment awareness and then the silent present moment awareness. Yeah. Because, to be honest, it's pretty much the same. I mean, I don't know. Try it and see. He does emphasize that idea of like the silent present moment awareness before beginning with the breath. I'm not sure. I haven't listened to his meditation teachings for a while, so I'm not sure if he's still teaching that way. Is he still doing that? Certainly, he was a while ago. Anyway, actually, that period of like silent awareness, I tend to do it. Not necessarily formalize it so much, but that's also very similar to the practice that was taught by my teacher Ajahn Mahachatchai, who called the same thing basically Jipen Glang, or the mind in the middle, which is basically a period of mindful awareness, just being aware of what's there, being aware of what's present in the mind, until you reach a point of sort of reasonable degree of quiet and equanimity with those things. So obviously, you know, when you talk about silent awareness at the beginning of the meditation, you have to be reasonable, right? I mean, you can't just say, okay, you've got to get to a point where there's like, your mind's completely silent for long periods of time and then you can begin your meditation. I mean, you can do that if you like, but for most people, they're probably not going to get very far past that stage. So it's about finding that quiet and finding that stillness there. The main thing, I think, is that that there's not this sense of rushing into the meditation and grabbing hold of the breath and sort of using it in that way. And it certainly was from Ajahn Brahm that I first sort of learnt that much. He has a much more sort of gentle and much more emotional relation to the breath, rather than a more kind of the breath is an object and you have to fix your meditation on the mindfulness on the object and so on. And so that kind of much more receiving tendency in Ajahn Brahm's teaching is where I kind of, you know, I learned a lot from that as well. All right. Okay, so for the last period of time, we've been doing... Oh, maybe just remind people, if you can, turn on your cameras. That is excellent. I can see who I'm talking to. That's nice. Most of the rains, I ended up teaching a series of suttas, and during this period I've been going back, revising my translations and doing annotations for the suttas, which has been really an interesting process for me. It's been much more, I've learned a lot more, to be honest, than I thought I would. I thought it was going to be a relatively straightforward process, go back over suttas, write a few notes, just clarify a few details. Hilarious. The sweet naivety of youth a year ago. And as I go forward, I'm very much kind of exploring and finding out new things. And I kind of feel like I'm sort of learning things pretty much every day and through this process. And so I started giving some teachings based on the suttas that I've been studying in this way, part of the reason being that... if something's fresh in your mind, then you always have kind of an enthusiasm, and so hopefully that's infectious. Last week we did Madhyama 38, Mahatamha Sankhaya Sutta, one of the great wisdom suttas of the Madhyama Nikaya, but we only got halfway, and so I said that I would finish it off today. So let's do that. So this will probably be the last one in this series. I'm not saying I might do it again in the future, but I'll just sort of see what happens next week. But we'll maybe wrap it up here and read the start with the... we're about halfway through the Mahatamha Sankhaya Sutta, the great discourse on the ending of craving. For those of you who weren't here last week, we have the previously on recap, which tells you that this is a conversation began when Sati, the fisherman's son, had the following harmful misconception. As I understand the Buddha's teaching, it is this very same consciousness that roams and transmigrates, not another. And so, according to the Buddha's teaching, there is such a thing as transmigration, and consciousness does indeed transmigrate, but it is not that very same consciousness, because consciousness is dependently originated, which means that it's always impermanent and it's always changing. So it's not that very same consciousness, which of course is a variety of view of a self, which the Buddha rejected. So the Buddha, having given a bit of a dressing down to poor old Sati, then went and started a series of questions and answers with the mendicants who were present, and went through dependent origination. And we got up to about halfway, and we'll begin just by briefly overlapping with the passage we read, I think, last week. And after questioning about whether they had were speaking of things that they had known for themselves, the Buddha went on, "Good mendicants, you have been guided by me with this teaching that is apparent in the present life, immediately effective, inviting inspection and relevant, so that sensible people can know it for themselves. For when I said that this teaching is apparent in the present life, immediately effective, inviting inspection, relevant, so that sensible people can know it for themselves, this is what I was referring to." In other words, the teaching on the realization of dependent origination. Now, the Buddha then goes on, having already given a very interesting and dynamic and important passage, goes on to introduce a whole bunch of new and very interesting ideas. Let us continue. "Mendicants, when three things come together, an embryo is conceived. In a case where the mother and father come together, but the mother is not in the fertile phase of a menstrual cycle, and the virile spirit is not ready, the embryo is not conceived. If the mother and father come together, the mother is in the fertile phase of a menstrual cycle. But the virile spirit is not ready, the embryo is not conceived. But when these three things come together, the mother and father come together, the mother is in the fertile phase of a menstrual cycle, and the virile spirit is ready, an embryo is conceived. All right? So this is a passage on conception. Now, let me just say before going on that this passage on conception is clearly not a Buddhist view. It's clearly a Brahmanical view. It's taught as a Brahmanical view in Majjhima Nikaya number 93, Asalayana Sutta, where it makes a lot more sense and fits with the context a lot better. And in my view, it obviously was cut and pasted from that context into the present context. Okay, so any attempts to sort of reconcile this as a Buddhist view, I think, are kind of missing the point a little bit. I think that historically it was added there by the redactors. Just to briefly, let me clarify a couple of points with it. I'm going to do a bit of a poll. Let's go. So the first thing, okay, so three factors. First of all, the mother and father come together, so it's fairly obvious. If you don't understand about what's happening there, then your basic education needs some help. But anyway, the mother is not in the fertile phase of a menstrual cycle. So this is a kind of a detail that's kind of was tricky to figure out and to translate. The Pali word is uduni, which literally means in season. And uduni is used in some places as a time of menstruation, right? So, you know, when the blood is there and so on, then this is the uduni. But it's also sometimes, it was also said that in one place it's taboo for Brahmins to have sex outside of the uduni. All right? So this is kind of weird, right? And there's obviously, and we know that it's associated with the blood and so on. There's this passage in the Vinaya where King Pasenadi has like hemorrhoids or something like that, and he's bleeding, and all of his wives are laughing at him and saying, "Oh, it looks like the king's on his period now." And so we know what's happening there. So what's actually going on? So I had to sort of do quite a bit of research to discover this. And it seems that it depends on the conception of fertility in ancient Indian medicine. Basically, the conception of fertility comes by inference from observing the rainfall on the fields. See, the word uduni literally means in season, like the seasons actually that happen. So in the dry season, no rain falls and nothing grows, right? But then the rains come, this field becomes soft and moist, the seeds which are implanted will then grow. And it seems that a woman's menstrual cycle was understood by analogy with that. So the period when the blood comes is a period when the uterus is made moist and fertile and receptive. And so the uduni actually encompasses from the start of the period to for the next fortnight or so. That's the uduni. And outside of that was considered to be the infertile period, the dry period. That's why you have the uduni is both when the woman is menstruating, but also is the time when, for Brahmins, it was allowable to have intercourse. So that's the uduni, and so that's why I've just translated it as the fertile phase of the menstrual cycle. Okay, so that bit was fairly straightforward. Relatively speaking, the next bit is about the virile spirit, which is the Gandharva. Now, I'm just going to gloss over this a little bit, because if I were to go into all of the details of what Gandharva means, it would be so horrifying and disturbing that you probably wouldn't sleep tonight. So if you think that you want to know about this, you probably don't want to, because it is so very disturbing. If you want to hear about it, you know, I'm not going to judge. I'm not going to judge like hardly at all. But
it was Halloween.
It was Halloween this week. Yeah, it's very appropriate. Yeah. When I was reading it, I was thinking that this would make a great horror movie. Yeah. So I don't know. What do you think? You probably read it on Discourse, right? You haven't read it. So there's a post on Discourse that goes all about it. It's kind of like, look, I'm going to continue. I'm going to leave apart some of the more disturbing details and just briefly summarize that. There is a post on Discourse for it. Basically, what it says there in the Pali is the Gandharva. So the Gandharva is a kind of hyper-masculine spirit which appears to be a symbolic representation of man's semen, which is one of the things which is necessary for that rebirth to take place. So that's a kind of a relatively brief kind of summary of it. Of course, in the Buddhist tradition, the Gandharva is always being explained as being the being who is to take rebirth, right? So the being who's being driven by their karma to take rebirth at a particular time. Now, obviously, doctrinally, that's the correct explanation, right? But that often what happens with these doctrinal explanations, they don't really explain, well, why would the Buddha use that word there? If he meant it's just the being who's being reborn there, why didn't he just say that, right? Why did he use the Gandharva? And this is one of the reasons why I'm pretty confident that this was just inserted from this Brahmanical passage. The Buddha was happy to borrow things from places, but he would adapt them and change them if need be. So what's happening here, so just to sort of step back from that description, is that the Buddha is now giving a real world and organic example of what he describes in an abstract way, independent origination. So dependent origination describes the process of birth, growing up, development, aging, dying, and all of those kinds of things, but usually in an abstract fashion. Here, he's talking about it in a concrete way, which is one of the things that makes it really interesting. So these items, these at the beginning, we're talking about the conception of the embryo. This is talking in dependent origination. This is equivalent to consciousness and nama rupa, consciousness and name and form. So if you remember the start of dependent origination, it begins with
ignorance.
And then choices, sankhara, yeah? So this is your karma from a past life. And then
consciousness
and nama rupa, name and form, okay? And so these two are mutually dependent. Right, so they condition each other. So the normal sequence from consciousness to nama rupa, but they actually condition each other. And that's what is being described here. So that's what, in an abstract form, but in a concrete form, that's what's being described here. It's the essentially process of conception. We also find this in other suttas, most prominently in Digha Nikaya number 15, the Mahanidana Sutta. So the Buddha is now describing dependent origination, but starting with vijnana and nama rupa. Okay, we good? Okay. So then the next part: the mother nurtures the embryo in her womb for 9 or 10 months at a great risk to her heavy burden. Okay, Mahasangsayena. Obviously true, right? Obviously that's how pregnancy is, that it's a heavy burden. Well, I've never been pregnant, but it looks like it, and certainly very risky. When 9 or 10 months have passed, a mother gives birth at great risk to her heavy burden. When the infant is born, she nourishes it with her own blood, for mother's milk is regarded as blood in the training of the noble one. Yeah. So this is really kind of emphasizing the burden and the sacrifice and the suffering that the mother has to go through to carry the baby to term, to give birth, and then to continue to nourish it with her own blood. And just a sort of a small detail of textual interpretation here. In that last line, for mother's milk is regarded as blood in the training of the noble one. So this is the this is a phrase that the Buddha is using to say, well, this is my teaching, right? The training of the noble one is the Buddha. It means in Buddhism, this is what it means, right? One of the things that I've done through doing a lot of these annotations is to look at how Buddhist ideas connect with other ideas in different traditions. And we've already just seen that with the Gandhaba and so on, where you have an incredibly complex network of ideas and illusions and so on. But in this case, he's specifying, no, this is my thing, I'm saying this. And in fact, it does seem to be true. I've tried to find examples of that outside of Buddhism, and I can't find it. So it seems to be accurate description that this is an idea of the Buddha rather than being an idea that the Buddha adopted. Anyway, the boy grows up and his faculties mature. Yeah. So this is one of the things that's showing about how dependent origination works. Again, when you see the abstract series of 12 links of dependent origination, it kind of sounds like one thing happens and then another happens and another happens and so on. But this is something which is evolving and growing over time. It's just a summary of things. So what we're actually seeing here is a very early, and perhaps the very earliest, description of childhood development, from birth and growing up, and how that relates to who we become as adults. So your faculties mature, so the faculties is the sense faculties here, which obviously don't, like independent origination, you know, it's like you have the nama rupa, and then you have the six senses, right? Salayatana. But obviously, when in life, that just doesn't happen, right? So, you know, as an infant is growing, it takes time to actually learn how to use the senses and to actually figure out these things. And so that's a process of development. So the Salayatana is growing. He accordingly plays childish games such as toy plows, tip cat, somersaults, pinwheels, toy measures, toy carts, and toy bows. Okay? So there's actually a much longer list of children's games in Digha Nikaya number 1, so if you want to have a more of a look at that. But interesting how little games have changed. I mean, playing somersaults, playing with toy cars, I mean, really, it's basically the same as what a kid would do today. And also, it's kind of interesting that one of the most kind of spectacular findings from the Indus Valley civilization was a little bronze toy cart. So they actually recovered one of the toy carts. So that's like 1,000 years before the Buddha that people were playing with these toy carts. Now, but one of the things to notice here is that in the playing with the childish games and being distinguished by this, is that at this point that they're not mature and they're not making decisions and they're basically not really making karma. All right, so kids don't really make karma. I mean, maybe to a bit, right? But for most of the time, they don't really know what they're doing, and. And so they're just playing around with things. So when kids get angry or annoyed or whatever and so on, they're not really making karma in the same way that someone who's an adult would. So this is showing again that process. This is why they're kind of learning through playing these childish games. They grow up, their faculties mature further. They accordingly amuse themselves, supplied and provided with the 5 kinds of sensual stimulation. Sights known by the eye that are likable, desirable, agreeable, pleasant, sensual and arousing. Sounds known by the ear, smells known by the nose, tastes known by the tongue, and touches known by the body that are likable, desirable, agreeable, pleasant, sensual, and arousing. When they see a sight with the eyes, if it's pleasant, they desire it, but if it's unpleasant, they dislike it. They live with mindfulness of the body unestablished and their heart restricted. And they don't truly understand the freedom of heart and freedom by wisdom where those arisen, bad, unskillful qualities cease, without anything left over. All right, so this is again, this is now talking about the process of growing up. When you become an adult, that you live in a world, in a sensory world, where you participate and respond to that sensory world. You like something, you want to get it. You don't like something, you don't want to get it. And so you're starting to learn to make kamma. Right. So this is how you're craving. Right. So we're now at the point where craving is starting to happen. Right. We have six senses and contact, and feeling, and craving to respond to those kinds of things. And you don't understand. Yeah, and of course that's what it's like. This is what it's like when you're growing up and you're a teenager and you're a young adult or whatever, and you just, you know, you want to get what you want, and you don't really understand why you can't have what you want or what the cost is or what anything means, but you just know that you want it. Being so full of favoring and opposing. Right? Being so full of favoring and opposing. This is one of the things that kind of almost lizard-like emotional reactions that social media has trained us with. You know, you see something and you like it, right? Or maybe you dislike it depending on what platform you're on, and it's kind of tickling you to prioritize these kind of very kind of basic favoring and opposing. That's how you participate in the world. So the Buddha's like saying, actually, when you get caught up with that, this is how you get caught up in suffering, because you're just reacting to things all of the time. It's a really kind of fundamental property of social media that they are designed in order to hook into these serotonin cycles to get you liking things and getting you the things that you like. And it's why TikTok became so incredibly popular so quickly, because it mastered better than any other platform that ability to drip feed you with things that would give you that little bit of, oh yeah, that's good, oh yeah, that's good, oh yeah, that's good. Anyway, when you feel any kind of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, they approve, welcome, and keep clinging to it. This gives rise to relishing. So this is the relishing is a synonym for craving or tanha. Relishing feelings is grasping. That grasping is a condition for continued existence. Continued existence is a condition for rebirth. Rebirth is a condition for old age and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress to come to be. This is how this entire mass of suffering originates. And similarly, when they hear a sound with the ears, hear smell an odor with the nose, taste a flavor with the tongue, feel a touch with the body, or know an idea with their mind. If it's pleasant, they desire it. If it's unpleasant, they dislike it. They live with mindfulness of the body unestablished, and their heart restricted. And they don't truly understand the freedom of heart and freedom by wisdom, where those arisen bad, unskillful qualities cease without anything left over. So this obviously is talking about the full completion of that cycle of dependent origination. And so, you know, a number of things, again, just to note, is how that cycle is only really complete when you're an adult. And so children are sort of on the way there. To note how that cycle is embodied in an organic process that grows and develops over time. And, you know, I just have to sort of note that there are many different theories of dependent origination. Most of them are wrong. If you want me to list all the wrong theories of dependent origination, we could be here for quite some time. One of them is the theory that dependent origination is purely a structural teaching that does not have... So when they talk about things that are conditioned, that they're conditioned in the way that the upper stories of a building are conditioned on the lower stories. So all of these things form a structure, but it doesn't actually change over time. So clearly, as we see in this sutta, that's obviously not correct. Out of the various others, I won't bore you with all of the wrong views about dependent origination. But to me, this sutta and Digha Nikaya number 15 and some others in the Nidana Sanghita are really interesting contexts for dependent origination, because they bring it back to those real world examples. And so this is showing it's not just something which is a sort of a philosophical abstraction. It's not meant to be understood in that way. It's meant to be a description of how we come to suffer, which is the most real and meaningful and human thing that we can do, and something that we all share with each other. And we learn to trace back that suffering. And that suffering is a part of how we are embodied in this experience and in this existence that we've ended up in. And so the power of dependent origination is not just that we are trapped in this suffering and we can understand it, but it's also that we can do something about it. And that's where the Buddha moves on to next. What are we to do with it? This is how this entire mass of suffering originates. But consider, when a realized one arises in the world, perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. Of course, this is the Itipiso chant, which we recited at the beginning of the evening. And so that's good, right? So we have the Buddha arises in the world. It's better than if the Buddha does not arise in the world. Imagine how lost we would be. Yeah? We would be going on TikTok for wisdom. Well, maybe some of us wouldn't. Maybe we might find something else. There are other sources of wisdom that are better than TikTok, that's true. But still. And so we live in a time when the Buddha has appeared and when his teachings are available. And I think this is something which is really valuable, very rare, and very precious. Of course, it is fundamental in the Buddhist tradition that Buddhas appear as part of the natural course of events. The Buddha is not some kind of divine manifestation or savior or messenger or anything like that, but the Buddha is simply somebody who was confronted with this suffering and who had the sincerity, the energy, the dedication, the clarity, and the wisdom to look deeply into that and uncover the roots and to find a solution. And, luckily for us, to share it. So this is what we try to do, to find that solution to suffering. Okay, fine. The Buddha has realized with his own insight this world with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, gods and humans, and he makes it known to others. He proclaims a teaching that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing. So just briefly on this passage here, again, this is a standard passage, but good in the beginning, middle, and end, it doesn't have like necessarily like one specific meaning, but generally speaking, it means that it's good when you first hear it, it's good when you practice it, and it's good when you've realized the practice, and you can say, oh yeah, that was good, that worked. Yeah. And notice also it says, with the right meaning and phrasing, sattang sabhyanjanam. And this is something which is discussed in a number of places in the suttas, that the texts have to have the right meaning and they also have to have the right phrasing. But it's interesting that when you see a more detailed discussion of this, it's also, say if you hear somebody who has said something, it doesn't seem to be the same or doesn't seem to be right, then you question them and you determine, because sometimes it could be merely a change in the phrasing, which is not that important. So what's more important is to keep the meaning correct. So yes, it's important to keep the phrasing correct, which means keeping the wording, keeping the linguistic, the grammatical, all of those details, getting them as right as possible. But ultimately, it's the meaning that is more important. And so the Buddhist tradition has always taken this to heart and tried their best to preserve both the meaning and the letter of what the Buddha has been teaching. One of the ways that that's been done, without sort of going too much into the textual stuff, but one of the ways that it does that is through the use of repetitions. So when you add repetitions to things, think about it. So if the Buddha says, let go of your craving, for example, and then maybe you put in some repetitions, maybe some redactors at some point said, let go of your craving, thirst, desire, okay? Actually, it's the same meaning. It hasn't changed the meaning. But by reinforcing it with synonyms, you guard against the loss of text and the loss of meaning. Because even if one word gets lost or misinterpreted, then there are others to reinforce that meaning. So sometimes it seems the redactors would be okay with expanding things by adding synonyms and repetitions, but without changing the meaning of things. Okay. good in the meeting, and he reveals a spiritual life that's entirely full and pure. Yeah, again, a fundamental part of the Buddha's teachings. He's not just telling us how it is, he's telling us what we can do about it. And he's describing in a lot of detail how we can live our lives in order to find a way out of suffering. A householder hears that teaching, or a householder's child, or someone born in a good family. They gain faith in the realized one and reflect. Living in a house is cramped and dirty, but the life of one gone forth is wide open. It's not easy. Nayidang sukaram. For someone living at home to lead the spiritual life, utterly full and pure like a polished shell. Why don't I shave off my hair and beard, dress in ochre robes, and go forth from the lay life to homelessness? So we'll be taking applications on Sunday if you want to come along. We have Santi Monastery and Bodhinyana and plenty of places for all those who want to ordain. Of course, the Buddha is not saying it's impossible to practice Dhamma in the lay life. He says, not easy. And I mean, I've been a monk for nearly 30 years, but certainly for the period of time when I was practicing Dhamma before I became a monk, I can confirm that was true. It was not easy. I don't know, what do you think? Is that right? Is it easy? Hard? Notice also that it doesn't say that it's easy to do it when you've ordained either. Right? It's kind of skipped over a little bit in that passage. Yeah. And so there's this kind of reflection, you know, and I think there's something which is, to me there's something in there which is like there's a calling in Buddhism. Yeah. And this is why I don't think that you can really ever have a form of Buddhism that's like entirely secularized, entirely gets rid of monastic orders. Because it's not about, you know, these days, you know, you hear everyone saying, oh, how do I apply Dhamma to my daily life? But rarely do you hear people saying, how can I apply my daily life to the Dhamma? Yeah? And so it's not a matter necessarily of fitting the Dhamma into all the things that you're doing. I mean, it's not saying you shouldn't do that. I'm just saying that that's just one way of doing it. The Buddha was calling us to consider changing our life and to live in a way that was in accord with the Dhamma as much as we possibly could. And so that, if you feel like a sense of sometimes a sense, oh, maybe I wish I could do that, oh, I don't know if I could, or I don't know. That's what it's there for. That's the point. Right? The point is to challenge us and to call us out and to give us a vocation and a calling to say, well, maybe we can do more. I wonder what we could do next. I wonder where we can go. I wonder how much we can achieve. Okay. So then it goes from there to discuss the gradual training. And I won't go into all of the details of the gradual training, but to sum it up briefly, the gradual training gives the teaching on sila, its ethics, on samadhi and meditation, and on banya, on wisdom, from a monastic perspective. And it details those three things. And what we have here in in the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta is a kind of a medium-sized version of that gradual training. It's taught in more detail in the Digha Nikaya, especially in Samanyapala Sutta, and in very different ways in many other places. So let's have a look briefly at what the gradual training says. After some time, they give up a large or small fortune and a large or small family circle. They shave off their hair and beard, dress in ochre robes, and go forth from the lay life to homelessness. Once they've gone forth, they take up the training and livelihood of the mendicants. They give up killing living creatures, renouncing the rod and sword. They're scrupulous and kind, living full of compassion for all living beings. They give up stealing. They take only what's given and expect only what's given. They keep themselves clean by not thieving. They give up unchastity. They're celibate, set apart, avoiding the vulgar act of sex. They give up lying. They speak the truth and stick to the truth. They're honest and trustworthy and don't trick the world with their words. They give up divisive speech. They don't repeat in one place what they heard in another so as to divide people against each other. Instead, they reconcile those who are divided, supporting unity, delighting in harmony, loving harmony, and speaking words that promote harmony. They give up harsh speech. They speak in a way that's mellow, pleasing to the ear, going to the heart, polite, likable, and agreeable to the people. They give up talking nonsense. Their words are timely, true, and meaningful, in line with the teaching and training. They say things at the right time, which are valuable, reasonable, succinct, and beneficial. So this is the kind of fundamental description of these ethical principles. And notice that these expand on the teachings and the five precepts. So these days in Theravada Buddhism especially, we emphasize a lot on the five precepts. In fact, in the suttas, it talks more about what I've just described there than it does list the five precepts, actually. This is more common. And you can see that it's not just not killing, but it's also living full of compassion for all sentient beings. Yeah? It's not just not lying, but it's also using speech in a meaningful way to bring benefit to people. And so this is like a fuller and more meaningful description of ethical life than we get from just the precepts. Moving on, so that's the main ethical principles, and then there's some more which go into some of the monastic rules, or not monastic rules, but monastic principles. They avoid injuring plants and seeds. They eat in one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and food at the wrong time. They avoid seeing shows of dancing, singing, and music. They avoid beautifying and adorning themselves with garlands, perfumes, and makeup. They avoid high and luxurious beds. They avoid receiving gold and money. Raw grains, raw meat, women and girls, male and female bondservants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants, cows, horses and mares, and fields and land. They avoid running errands and messengers, buying and selling, falsifying weights, measures or metals, bribery, fraud, cheating and duplicity, investment in cryptocurrency. Mutilation, murder, abduction, banditry, plunder, and violence. So these are a list of things, obviously, which monastics should be avoiding. And I think most of them are pretty straightforward in terms of things that are not a good idea for monastics. Just briefly to note on the thing about what they avoid running errands and messages. The implication there is that in ancient India in those times, the monastics were wanderers. So they were going from one place to another all the time. So it was kind of convenient to say, oh, could you take a letter here? Could you take a message there? And in fact, they were also employed as spies. And this is discussed quite a bit in the Arthashastra, which came about 100 or 200 years after the Buddha. And so monks, the best spies, are monks and prostitutes. Yeah, these are the best ones because they all hear everybody's secrets. Actually talks about this even in the suttas as well, that the King Pasenadi was using various ascetics as spies. So this is what's implied by the running errands and so on. Yeah, also like no mutilation or murder, definitely not. Okay, very good. They're content with robes to look after the body and alms food to fill the belly. Wherever they go, they set out taking only these things. They're like a bird, wherever it flies, wings are its only burden. When they have this entire spectrum of noble ethics, they experience a blameless happiness inside themselves. So this is, I'll just continue then, that when they see a sight with their eyes, they don't... let me just say, what we've talked about so far, right? Remember, we're in the context of dependent origination and we're in the context of undoing dependent origination. And so dependent origination being driven by those sankharas, by those ethically choices that we make, we've now refrained from or constrained a whole bunch of those kinds of sankharas, which are no longer being done. right? Which you've given up all of those bad acts and all those killings. So that's like already sidelined a sort of massive amount of samskaras. And we're now starting to move from the more coarse things towards the more subtle things. So then to sense restraint, then when they see a sight with the eyes, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of sight were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of covetousness and displeasure would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of sight and achieving its restraint. So that the unskillful qualities of covetousness and displeasure, this is abhijja domana sang, it's the same phrase you find in Satipatthana, in the mindfulness meditation. And so this is essentially is when we're living, when we're seeing things, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching things, don't allow yourself to be overwhelmed by the things that you're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. So it's not saying, this is not talking about some kind of pure equanimity or enlightened state of mind or anything like that. It's talking about having some mindfulness, having some awareness, so that we don't let ourselves get trapped in these things. I mentioned a little bit before about how social media, also advertising, all of these things, they work specifically to try to get you to get caught up in these things. That's why these industries exist, is to get you to lose your mindfulness and lose your awareness and just get caught in that kind of role of scrolling things or seeing things or following them or whatever. Right? So mindfulness and restraint, yeah, have some inner sense, some quality of having some groundedness that you are in here, and that thing that you're experiencing is just a sight, actually. It's just a sound. It's okay. Sights are all right. Sounds all right. These things are fine. You know, you want to, if you're crossing a road, you want to see what's coming down the road. These things are good. Right? But there's a difference between like having senses that are helping you and you're learning from, and having senses that that you become a slave to and become entrapped by. Okay. When they have this noble sense restraint, they experience an unsullied bliss inside themselves. Also very important to know, the Buddha was not a kind of a hard taskmaster. He didn't want us to be miserable. He wanted us to be happy. And so the purpose of doing these things is not so that we can just torment ourselves. This is the extreme that the Buddha rejected. But it's so we can find deeper and more lasting and more meaningful forms of happiness. Okay, they act with situational awareness when going out and coming back, when looking ahead and aside, when bending and extending the limbs, when bearing the outer robe, bowl and robes, when eating, drinking, chewing and tasting, when urinating and defecating, when walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, waking, standing, sitting, sleeping, waking, speaking and keeping silent. One of the very distinctive teachings of the Buddha about keeping that awareness with you through everything that you're doing. When they have this entire spectrum of noble ethics, this noble sense restraint, and this noble mindfulness and situational awareness, they frequent a secluded lodging, a wilderness, the root of a tree, a hill, a ravine, a mountain cave, a charnel ground, a forest, an open air, and a heap of straw. And so, you know, if you are looking to practice the Dhamma, then a really good place to do that is at Santi Forest Monastery, where they, in fact, have every single one of those things. They have a wilderness. They have a root of a tree, a hill, a ravine, a mountain cave, charnel ground. There's a cemetery in the local village. You can go and meditate there. A forest, open air, and a heap of straw. I don't know if they still have a heap of straw, but anyway, sometimes when I was there, we had heaps of straw if you wanted to meditate on that. I don't know if you would, but anyway. That's why. Also kind of bear in mind, you know, when we meditate in our apartment or in our home, and we come to a Dhamma center or something like that to meditate. Okay, that's fine. We do what we can with what we can. But is it the same as meditating in a cave in the forest? Probably not exactly, right? So this is, again, it's not about saying that we should be kind of dissatisfied or whatever with what we have and what we can do. And it's not about saying that we can't do that. But it is about saying maybe we could do more. Maybe we'll get a chance one day to go to Santi Monastery or to go to somewhere in Sri Lanka or Thailand or so many places. In the United States, there's some great meditation monasteries as well. And so to actually find some places where we can really experience this. After the meal, they return from arms round, sit down cross-legged, set their body straight and establish mindfulness in front of them. Giving up covetousness for the world, they meditate with a heart rid of covetousness, cleansing the mind of covetousness. Giving up ill will and malevolence, they meditate with a mind rid of ill will, full of compassion for all living beings, cleansing the mind of ill will. Giving up dullness and drowsiness, they meditate with a mind perceiving light, mindful and aware. Giving up restlessness and remorse, their mind is peaceful inside, cleansing the mind of restlessness and remorse. Giving up doubt, they meditate, having gone beyond doubt, not undecided about skillful qualities, cleansing the mind of doubt. So here in the gradual training, it doesn't specify what meditation that you're doing. And so clearly it could be any of the meditations that the Buddha was teaching, most commonly mindfulness of breathing, as we did earlier this evening, but metta meditation or any of the other meditations that you want to do also would be part. The main point is that we're letting go of the five hindrances. So they give up these five hindrances, corruptions of the heart that weaken wisdom. Then, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities, they enter and remain in the first absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion while placing the mind and keeping it connected. Further, as the placing of mind and keeping it connected are still, the mendicant enters and remains in the second absorption, the third and the fourth absorption. So this is the four jhanas. When they see a sight with their, and then following that, when they see a sight with their eyes, if it's pleasant, they don't desire it. If it's unpleasant, they don't dislike it. They live with mindfulness of the body established and a limitless heart. So this is now resuming from the passage or giving the counterpart for the passage on being attached to the senses. So after the practice of jhanas, the mind has been cleansed and the hindrances have been suppressed to such a deep degree that the sensory impingements and contacts don't disturb the mind to anything like the same degree. This is something that's just worth dwelling on just a little bit. After the practice of jhanas by itself doesn't completely or permanently eradicate that your sort of desire or the push and pull and so on of the senses, right? But what it does do is it just like blows away all of the hindrances and just like clarifies the mind to such an incredible degree that they just don't come around for quite some time afterwards. You know, even maybe many days, and if you're practicing jhanas regularly, you can even go for many years at a time without having any hindrances in your mind, right? Because that power of the jhana is so strong. Which is why, of course, some people think that they're enlightened. They haven't had any defilements for years, right? They're practicing deep meditation. But there's still the potential is still there that it might come up. So it's really important to remember, like, you know, when they say that, you know, jhana suppresses the defilements, but it doesn't permanently eradicate them, this is true. But it doesn't mean that the defilements are all just going to pop back up just like they were before as soon as you're out of the jhanas, you know. Years ago when I had a conversation with somebody who's one of the students at in Perth at the Buddhist Society there, and he said he went to a teaching with some teacher who, and everybody who was on that retreat, this was a non-residential retreat. They sort of go in and practice and then go back home in the evening, and said so many people on that retreat would be going to the teacher and telling them how they'd been doing this jhana and that jhana and so on. And then the teacher would be like kind of nodding and not really sort of saying anything about that. And the fellow who was telling me about this was saying, I really don't understand this, you know. I mean, how can they be sitting in this jhana and then just getting up and chatting about what they're going to be eating for dinner or what telly they're going to be watching when they get home? I mean, this is not how it is. He said, I don't really know much about these things. I don't know much about, you know, deep meditations and so on. But he said there was one time when he was staying in a monastery in Myanmar for like 6 months, And in that time, there was one meditation that he went into where he just felt like everything disappeared, like the whole world vanished, and he just went into this place of stillness and light and peace. And he said when he came out of that, it was like he was walking around on the air for days, and just like his mind was like completely pure and clear and just completely transformed. And it took, you know, he wasn't able to really stabilize that meditation at the time, but at the same time the meditation didn't, you know, it didn't just disappear. And saying, how can these people be going into these deep states of meditation and then just coming back and everything's just like normal again? And yeah, good question. Okay. So yes. So after the jhana, after that practice, and when you hear sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, or things that you know with your mind, ideas you know with your mind, if it's pleasant, you don't desire it. When it's unpleasant, you don't dislike it. You live with mindfulness of the body established and a limitless heart, and you truly understand the freedom of heart and freedom by wisdom, where those arisen, bad and unskillful qualities cease without anything left over. Having given up favoring and opposing, when they experience any kind of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant or neutral, they don't approve, welcome or keep clinging to it. As a result, relishing of feelings ceases. When their relishing ceases, grasping ceases. When grasping ceases, continued existence ceases. When continued existence ceases, rebirth ceases. When rebirth ceases, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress cease. This is how this entire mass of suffering ceases. And so that's the culmination of dependent origination. So this is putting dependent origination not merely within the putting the origin of dependent origination within the practical context of the birth and growth and development of a child, and then putting the ending of dependent origination within the practical context of practicing the Dhamma. And the Buddha concludes by saying, mendicants, you should memorize this brief statement on freedom through the ending of craving. But the mendicant Sati, the fisherman's son, is caught in a vast net of craving, a tangle of craving. That is what the Buddha said, and satisfied, the mendicants approved what the Buddha said. So this is the Maha Dhamma Sankhaya Sutta, the great discourse on the ending of craving, and I hope that was beneficial for you. I enjoyed it. So that's something, I guess. Any questions before we wrap up? Yeah.
I think it's kind of implied, but I just thought I'd double check. So when the hindrances are suppressed, like, you know, after you come out of like a deep meditation, does that mean then that the greed, hatred, and delusion are also sort of
suppressed? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they don't really manifest. Yeah.
So that's why. Okay. That's why there's some people can sort of think that they're.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's not even just that some people can think that they're enlightened.
Yeah.
It's that that falsely thinking that your enlightenment is a normal part of the spiritual path that most people will go through. I remember my friend who's a monk, when I was a young monk in Thailand, he's like, I really kind of respect those people who can fool themselves that they're enlightened. He said, because there's no way that I could do that. So if someone's at a place in their path where they can kid themselves that they're enlightened, then he said, oh, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's not doing too bad. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And after dinner, we were discussing choices, the second factor.
Okay.
In the Eightfold Path. And so the question came up, like, if you don't have choices, then, like, after you're enlightened, and how do you do things? Mm-hmm. So is the answer, like, if there's no ignorance, then you don't have certain choices?
Right, yeah.
Like, you have choices, obviously.
Yeah.
But you don't have choices that lead to
suffering.
Sure. Right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, I mean, sankhara for choices there is punyabhi sankhara, apunyabhi sankhara, and enjabhi sankhara, meritorious, demeritorious, and imperturbable choices, which is based on fourth jhana and above. So basically, all of those mean kinds of choices that lead to certain results, good results, bad results. Yeah, so those kinds of choices you don't have, yeah.
What's the thing about the three lifetimes or something?
Okay, but what's, okay, thanks for that. I'm happy that you didn't preface with that with like just a small question. What's that whole thing about the three lifetimes? Okay, so in the Buddhist tradition, so what they do is they take the teaching of dependent origination and they analyze it as being occurring over the avidya and sankhara, happened in the past life, and then they condition rebirth into this life, which is vijnana and so on, and then it goes to the next life, which is, you know, bhava and then getting reborn and so on. So you can sort of make a scheme for talking about three lives. It's a little bit too cut and dried because it's not quite as linear than that. I mean, for example, consciousness is a process or a stream that flows from life to life, right? It's being conditioned to flow in that way. So it's not like there's no consciousness in the previous life and then it only appears in this life. So it's a little bit, that sort of scheme is a little bit cut and dried, but it's mostly sort of an expositional method. And that method is used throughout the Buddhist traditions, as far as I'm aware, that basically all the Buddhist traditions explain dependent origination in the same way. You know, I don't tend to sort of emphasize the fact that it's three lifetimes quite so much, but definitely that's more or less what the suttas are saying, right? So it's definitely talking about that process of, you know, being reborn and then, you know, moving on to the next life and so on. Yeah.
Some people say that it's in this
life. I know some people do say it's in this life. That's wrong. Yes, those people are like Sati, the fisherman's son. Obviously, you can see all of dependent origination happening in this life because it isn't like avidya and sankhara only exist in the past life and then these sort of things only exist here. We can see ignorance and so on happening here. But the full extent of it happens over those different lifetimes. That's the point of the point. The purpose of... It's really helpful if you just understand the basic thing is the purpose of dependent origination is to explain how rebirth happens without a soul.
In terms of what you mentioned about children making karma,
right.
I was wondering about the connection between the sutta in which the Buddha was teaching Rahula about making moral choices, and I think Rahula was about 7.
Okay.
Is there any kind of implication about at that age you're starting to make
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So around about 7, and there's a number of places where it kind of talks about that, you know, from the age of roughly 7-something, that you're starting to actually know right and wrong. And I think developmentally, that's how it is. I mean, you've got some... Jenny, you're a mum, you can... and Heidi, you guys are mums, you know more about this than I do.
I just heard about that recently.
Yeah.
Oh, my son, literally.
Yeah. So you learned about that from your son, okay, that's good to know, yeah. Good to know. And again, it's not a black and white thing. I mean, you obviously have moral sensibilities among animals as well, you know. And you know, I remember when one story I read years ago about a woman who was working with, I think, chimpanzees or something, teaching them sign language, and then they had to sort of, I don't know what, like transport them. This chimp that she was working with, that she, you know, she they would learned all these signs. And she had to, like, I don't know, move him or put him somewhere to have a medical treatment or something like that. So she basically had to trick him with a banana to get into a cage and then sort of quickly lock the cage door behind him. And then he just kind of turned around her and just gave her this look and then just signed dirty at her. Yeah. Uh-huh. Interesting, right? So there is that kind of moral kind of consciousness in that kind of nascent form, but it's not like really kind of fully formed in that same way. Yeah. Oh, go, Sinsin, go.
Okay.
Somebody.
I wanted to ask this question last week, but I didn't have time. It's not important, but just out of curiosity. If we're talking about spiritual, physical mediumship, for example, people who are physical mediums or clairvoyants or
anything. All right,
and
yep.
They claim that they can be possessed with a
okay.
Or whatever.
Right.
They have no idea of what's happening.
Okay.
The spirit is taking control.
Right.
Whose consciousness is that and who's making the karma? And I'm a bit skeptical about this too, but then
yeah,
if
sure.
That is the case.
Okay, so for those online, Sinsin's asking a question about, well, in what about the case of mediumship? If somebody is like possessed by a spirit, then whose karma is that owned? Interestingly enough, there's a little side detail. Remember the Gandhaba that we talked about earlier a little bit? They also are known for possessing people. That's one of their whole things. Yes, and exactly the meaning of how they possess people and what that means is that's where it starts to get very, very disturbing. So I won't go into that. Okay? But the whole idea of possession is disturbing enough, right? Look, I'm by no means an expert on it and so on, so I don't really kind of know. Can it happen? I couldn't say. Whose karma is it if they're involved? Well, I guess it's the karma of the possessing entity, isn't it? I mean, if somebody's possessing you, then you're not in control. Yeah.
So where's the possessed person while they're possessing
him? Asleep? I don't know. I mean, from what I've heard, and I have read some books on it, again, I'm very far from being an expert, is that in those kind of cases, usually the possessed person is completely unaware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And then they have to ask other people, like, what did they say? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But is that also the case for someone who's has some sort of very strong mental health episode where they're
right.
Not making strong karma?
Right. Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so if somebody's having, it's similar to like in law as well, like if somebody's having a psychotic, an episode of psychosis or something, then they're not responsible for their actions. Yeah, that's the case all through the Vinaya, that if somebody's mad, which means basically that they're having a psychotic break, that they're not responsible for their actions. Yeah. Roy, sorry, go on.
But for these mediums, they do have the ability to decide whether they want to be possessed or not, right? So they can make choices.
Right. Okay. Well, in that case,
if they allow this to happen,
right?
If that means it's their choice.
Yeah. If a medium can make the choice whether to be possessed, then yes, they have the karmic responsibility for making the choice, but they don't have the karmic responsibility for what is done.
You know, like a lot of people are having psychotic episodes due to taking methamphetamine.
Right.
And, you know,
right.
Initial choice, but then
yes.
They know what they're doing
instead. Yeah. So yeah, it does get complicated. Yeah. Before you come on, Ishika. Sorry, Roy.
I just wanted to understand further about the the meditative side of that. People hitting jhana a lot in their meditation.
Okay.
You mentioned that
people hitting jhana a lot in their meditation. Okay, nice. Sorry.
I don't know. That's the reason why I'm asking you.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever experienced it before, but the description was it's like walking on air. You say. And,
afterwards, yeah.
But is that do you hear a lot of lay people getting in their own practice getting to jhana?
Well, that was the
life environment, not in a retreat or in a.
Do I hear a lot of stories like that? No.
Yeah, coming from a lay person.
No.
No. Okay. So, it's not really the environment of the lay life is not really conducive to hit that kind of.
Nai dang sukarang, not easy. But then look, you know, there are some people. Obviously, there are always kind of exceptions to this. But there's one person I know who. Came to me one time when I was in Malaysia, and she's like, "Oh, I'll tell you a problem. I have a problem with sleeping. Really, I haven't been able to get to sleep." I'm like, "Oh, really? Tell me what happens." She said, "Well, I lie down at night, and then I watch my breathing, and then as I watch my breath, the breath keeps on getting brighter and brighter and brighter until my mind's just filled with light, and then I'm just lying there with my mind filled with light the entire night, and I can't get to sleep." I'm like, "Oh, really? That sounds terrible." Yeah. And do you feel tired the next day? She said, no, I feel fine. I think it's probably okay.
In that context, like, does it come down to like a person who's already towards their retirement, who has an easier life rather than having a job where it's so confronting, you know?
Honestly, there's so many variables, you know, I wouldn't really want to generalize. Obviously, it's got to do with past karma, right? Oh. I mean, that's obviously part of it. And how you're living your life and so many things, you know? So all we can say is what is the next step for us? You know, that's all. You know, the Buddha gives us this ideal, and we can say, well, where do we go from here? Like, what's our next step? And you know, there's no sort of shame or anything with not being at the peak of the mountain, you know. It's giving us an orientation in life, and it's giving us a challenge. So as long as we can let go of what is unwholesome and develop what is wholesome, then we're moving in the right direction. Yeah. Ishika, you had a question.
So in the case of a medium, like,
right?
do they get possessed without making that choice?
Look, I honestly don't know. I don't know enough about the field to be able to say, and I don't know to what extent any of these things are real or not. I don't really have any kind of opinions about it.
Because there are cases where people get possessed.
There are cases where people appear to be possessed, yeah. And whether they do, I mean, like in some cases they definitely do it deliberately, you know, so you definitely sort of do a kind of a ritual or a ceremony and so on, and people can, yeah, and people can do it in a repeated way. So you can sort of set it up and you can do it like that. But it also, I'm sure it happens spontaneously as well. Yeah.
So then, like, they're more powerful than, a human? Like, I don't know.
More Gandhabha. Powerful?
Gandhabha?
A Gandhabha? Are they more powerful? No, not at all. And I think this is one of the great delusions of that, you know. Mm-hmm. From a Buddhist point of view, let's say that you are being possessed, right? So who the hell is doing that? I mean, seriously, I mean, what kind of, if it's some heavenly being or some spirit or something like that, what are you doing slumming around in the humanity? Like, why would you want to come down and possess people? So this is why, like, stories of the Gandhabha possessing people, it's kind of creepy, right? Let's just take it on its face value. Let's assume that it's true, that you are genuinely being possessed and you're genuinely channeling the world of some spirit. What kind of spirit would do that? It's creepy. It's weird, yeah. And that so. There was one book that I read about this years ago. I was in Bodhinyana Library actually, and it was done by an investigative journalist who was just interested. He wasn't hyper skeptical. He wasn't a believer, but he joined this group and he just wanted to sort of understand what was the dynamics in the group. And one of the things that he found. So in that particular group, there was a young woman who would they'd have these meetings, and she would be possessed. And she would say all of these kinds of things, and then afterwards she wouldn't remember any of it. But one of the things that he... And when he got there, he found himself getting more and more caught up in this whole thing, because you're surrounded by everyone who believes it, and everyone's sort of taking the words of these things as some kind of authority, you know? And then he sort of, even though he came from just an investigative point of view, began getting more and more...